Kinder nicht mehr in Freiheit und in einem Rechtsstaat aufwachsen. Und was ich ganz toll finde, die Omas gegen Rechts haben inzwischen 30.000 Mitglieder. Und das Motto der Omas ist, du darfst nicht schlafen in der Demokratie, sonst wachst du in der Diktatur auf. Du darfst nicht schlafen in der Demokratie, sonst wachst du in der Diktatur auf. Und jetzt schlage ich mal den ganz großen Bogen von dem Nahbereich der Omas zu dem, was im Großen und im Globalen passiert. Und zu Menschen, die sich eben mit diesen großen Fragen aber im selben Zusammenhang beschäftigen. Dem Rechtsruck in der Welt, dem Erstarken von Autokratien und mit welcher Begeisterung viele Menschen demokratiefeindliche und menschenrechtsfeindliche Politiker unterstützen. Ich sage bewusst Politiker, weil es sind halt doch, wir haben ja auch Giorgia Meloni und so, kann man ja auch nicht gerade vergessen, aber es sind halt in der Regel trotzdem Männer. Zwei großartige Denker und Analytiker, die sich mit diesen Fragen befassen, hat Eva Menasse zu uns eingeladen. Und hier kommt der Leitfaden zum Weltuntergang.
Please. Es sind zwei Weltstars heute bei uns in Hamburg, Ivan Krastev und Fintan O'Toole. Herzlich willkommen. Dear Ivan, dear Fintan, a very warm welcome to our third Penn Berlin Congress. We are incredibly honored and it's such a pleasure also for me personally to have you both here. A short introduction in English. Ivan Krastev, many of you might know, is a political scientist and political advisor, chair of the Center for Liberal Strategies in Sofia, permanent fellow of the IWM, the Institut für die Wissenschaft vom Menschen in Vienna. Actually, I never asked you if you know this. They were the first, the IWM were the first who gave me a grant when I was like 28. So I'm still grateful to them. He is board member of the European Council on Foreign Relations of and of the International Crisis Group. He is contributing editor of the Financial Times and author of many books. The most recent one is It Tomorrow Yet? Auf Deutsch, Ist heute schon morgen, wie die Pandemie die Welt verändert? Erschienen bei Ullstein. And he is advising on a regular basis the political leaders of the world. I didn't ask you before how much you can share of this, but in any case, I can tell the audience, because I know it, it's public, that you have had lunch or dinner twice with Vladimir Putin. Maybe we can talk about this shortly later. Fintan O'Toole, whom I admire immensely, is advising editor of the New York Review of Books and a columnist with the Irish Times. This is the meager line he gave us when I asked for a biographical line. This is what I have to add. Might be a bit embarrassing for him, but actually it's more embarrassing for us here, because in truth, Fintan is one of the most distinguished and praised authors and commentators and essayists in the English-speaking world, widely read and admired. It is a miracle why this information never made it into Germany. So to all the publishers in this room, and there might be some, his last book is called We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Ireland Since 1958. It's a beautiful book, and it still waits for its German translation. So, Ivan, Fintan, we must and will talk about American presidential elections and their possible consequences for the world. But as we said before in our preparation talk, I'd like to start a little bit elsewhere from a wider perspective. You both have specialized on analyzing the reasons for the division and polarization of societies. Fintan, you are using the term political tribalization. And this is not just an American phenomenon, no, not at all, but has arrived almost everywhere in Europe, even now in Germany, with the rise of the AfD. Let's talk about some of these reasons for this rise. Your truly fascinating work, Fintan, takes its start from analyzing the bloody North Ireland conflict between 68 and 98, 30 years of terror and bloodshed. We might have forgotten this a little bit recently. When I first heard your lecture on this topic, you began with a quite uncomfortable question, whether this conflict really just belongs only to the past, or might be also read as an example for current or even future conflicts. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Thank you very much, Eva. Thank you so much for the invitation to be with you. It's a great pleasure to be here in solidarity, really, with the wonderful work that Penn Berlin is doing. I admire everything you've been working on greatly, and it's an honor to be with you. Yeah, so you wouldn't think it, but I'm 66. You would think I'm 86, perhaps, but you know. So for half of my life, really, on the islands of Ireland, there was this what at the time seemed like an anachronistic conflict. Right? So. The not very good joke was always, we used to say, you know, when you landed in Belfast, the captain of the aircraft would say, "Welcome to Belfast, put your watch back 1 hour and 300 years." So it seemed inexplicable in Western Europe, in a democracy, in a prosperous, you know, part of the Northern Hemisphere, that you could have an ethnic conflict which could continue for 30 years. And it seemed at the time like it was a kind of rent in the fabric of history, that something from the religious wars of the 16th and 17th centuries had sort of just continued in this weird little place, because it was essentially a sectarian conflict between Protestants and Catholics. So it was between white people, white Christians, white people who lived in very small communities, small societies, knew each other, you know, watched the same TV programs, listened to the same pop music. And that society became utterly polarized. There were historical reasons for this, of course, which I won't bore you with. But in 1966 or 67, most people thought those historical reasons are receding. Right. So, you know, there were venues like this. There were young people dancing and trying to have sex with each other or whatever they possibly do without saying, "Are you Protestant or Catholic?" I mean, you know, people just wouldn't have known this. We're talking to Van Morrison, for example, who would have been playing those clubs. You know, so, you know, the idea that you would want to know whether somebody was Protestant or Catholic just, you know, didn't exist. There was a lot more intermarriage going on. There was so it just felt like this was, yes, it was a historic legacy which would take time to overcome, but it was moving into the past. By 1968, this had become a sectarian conflict, and it lasted exactly for 30 years. So it didn't stop until 1998. And the terrifying thought for me is perhaps, so we always used to pray, you know, we'd say, wouldn't it be great if Northern Ireland could be more like the rest of the democratic world? And now what's happened is the rest of the democratic world has become more like Northern Ireland. and it is sort of interesting to think about why this could happen and how it could sustain itself. So the reasons, the whys we can kind of leave in the background a little bit. But the self-sustaining nature of a polarization of this kind, I think, is what is worth thinking about a little bit. Because There's really a couple of things that go on. One is that it is a kind of identity politics, but it's a politics of false identity. So in the 1960s, in the modern world, everybody's identity is actually very complex. One of the things that polarization does is, and you mentioned this, I think, it stops you having to think about who we are, because you just know you're not them. You're not those people. And that's a lot easier. You know, it sort of has a kind of, even though it's conflictual and violent and difficult, it sort of creates a kind of solidarity, which is welcome to some people. Secondly, it produces a kind of politics which doesn't have to deliver. So we were used, I mean, democracy is basically about having a contest about who can deliver more for the public good. And one of the things about this tribalization is that you can have a politics where you actually don't need to deliver anything. It just needs to be worse for them. You know, it just needs to be able to say, well, you know, so long as they're not gaining, it's okay. So a whole political class can come into being, which is no longer held to account by its own voters. So most politicians in Northern Ireland are still really terrible. They're really terrible at getting stuff done, doing stuff. When it comes to an election, they know that it doesn't matter how terrible they are. You know, people will still vote for them because they're our guys against the other guys. And if we don't vote for our guys, the other guys will win. So you get into that kind of existential thing where, you know, you have to sustain this. And what you get, and I'll stop with this, but is you also got this kind of, so it starts with a zero-sum game, right, which is you lose any sense that there is a mutuality of benefit. So democratic politics is supposed to be about the fact that we can all gain something, you know, if we have the right kinds of policies, if we act with the right kind of integrity, if we think about human equality, we can all gain. This kind of politics is about saying, well, actually, no, that's not what it's about. You lose any sense of mutual gain, and you start thinking it's a zero sum. If they're gaining, we're losing. If we're gaining, they must be losing. And that's the way people start seeing it. And why it can go on for 30 years is that it can go, there's a step further than that, which is not just a zero-sum game, but a minus-sum game, which is even if we're losing, it doesn't really matter so long as they're losing more, right? And you can see this emerging, for example, in American politics now, you know, which I'm sure we'll come on to talk about, you know, that. We've had this American election campaign, which is very, very light on discussion about anything, really, in terms of policy, in terms of actual economics, in terms of climate change, in terms of all the things we might think an election might be about. It's much more to do, particularly on the Trump side, about a kind of sadism, a kind of sense of, you know, sticking it to the people we really hate. That becomes the main driving force. And the scary thought about it is that if you don't stop it at a certain point, it can take on its own logic and its own momentum, because it becomes a logic of tit for tat, right? They did this to us, we have to do it back to them, and so on, and it can just take on its own life.
We're going to talk about the US elections a little bit later, as we agreed on. Just one more question, Fintan. You once mentioned in your talks this wonderful expression of the mope syndrome. Please give us what this is meaning.
So the one thing we preserved in Ireland was a sense of humor, I suppose. Somebody in Belfast came up with this idea of what they called mope syndrome. So in English, the word to mope is to really feel very sorry for yourself, you know, if you're moping, your teenager is moping in their room, you know, whatever you say. So mope syndrome, but mope in this case stands for, it's M-O-P-E, it stands for most oppressed people ever.
And so I think this applies also to very good to AfD politics put weight on that kind of feeling. Ivan, your thinking starts from a very different point. You have been analyzing quite a lot the disappointment of the Eastern European nations after the Cold War ended, and why it was so difficult for them to arrive in the praised Western world, and why all of a sudden the praised Western world didn't look that attractive anymore, and this particular disappointment and even frustration. How can this, what you learned there, be used as a pattern also to explain how this particular germ of right extremism or political tribalization is coming towards the West?
Yeah, thank you very much, and very proud to be here. Normally we speak on conferences, not on congresses, which is obviously promotion. Listen, in my view, something very simple has happened in 1989, and we're going to see the result later. And this was, what was the difference between time and space was that in space you can move and the time you cannot. And suddenly movement in space became the movement in time. If you try to see what happened to Eastern Europe after 1989, it was a kind of a massive migration of the East to the West. And it took two forms. Some did it individually, and then the whole states. And from this point of view, 1989, and basically the changes were very strange, because we're talking about the revolution, but you cannot imagine basically Trotsky taking a fellowship to study in Oxford. Why? Because he basically believed that what was the most important is what was happening in his own country. Well, basically, and all of us being in Eastern Europe, we said, we know the future. Our future is the West. And I don't have time to wait Bulgaria to become like Germany. Why not to go to Germany immediately? And one of the major things that happened in Eastern Europe and that people didn't see is that there was this major movement of people. And as a result of it, you have a major exodus. East Germany, almost 15% of the population left. And listen, it's not great to live in a place where others want to live. Even if you're doing fine, if you're better, suddenly, and particularly keep in Eastern Europe, you're talking about small nations, demographically declining. Bulgaria, by the way, is the fastest declining demographically nation in history in the absence of war or natural disaster. There were 9 million people living in 1989, and now they're less than 6.5 million. Imagine this, young people are living. By the way, when they're living, also all the money invested in their education and so on, living with them. So this created this strange moment in which opening of the borders was the best and the worst. The best that you can live, the worst because others are living.
But at the same time, these people don't want to have immigration.
But this is the most important, because they don't have to have an immigration, because suddenly they had the feeling they discovered the mortality of their nations. And most of these people, by the way, this is a major writer's problem in these countries. The question is in hungry tears anybody going to read in Bulgarian? And because normally nation was one of the ways, like children, to deal with our mortality. And we're living in a strange age. If you go to the United States, particularly to Silicon Valley, you are going to meet individuals who believe that they're going to live forever. When you move to Europe, you're going to see nations that are not going to be sure that they're going to survive the next 100 years. Suddenly, this mortality game changed. And by the way, the far-right voters are also migrants, and they want to basically also migrate in time. They want to go back. And not back to a better time, but back to a place that they knew. Back to Germany in 1970s, back to this. Back to a different ethnic mixed up of society. And I'm saying this because you are basically mentioning Putin. listen, nobody can understand what he did if he's not going to see two things. Extremely simple. Before invading Ukraine in February 24, 2 days earlier he invaded
22,
he invaded Soviet Union. He gave a major speech in which he basically blamed Soviet Union for the existing of the Ukrainian nation, for everything, and basically claimed that the Russians were the most basically ever repressed people in the world. And I'm saying this because in a strange way, this kind of a huge demographic anxieties, are we going to be here or not? This fear of the future, which is totally shared, this apocalyptic mindset creates something that you basically explains where you have this major radicalization. I was rereading all the interesting stuff being written just after the end of the Cold War. And paradoxically, it was neither Huntington nor basically Frank Fukuyama. The most interesting book came from a German writer. And this was Ernst Berger's book, Civil War, written in 1993, in which he made an observation, if you're going to reread the book now, you're going to be shocked. He said, we're entering a period of a molecular civil war, where everything is going to be about intensity. It's a violence that does not need justification anymore, where there is no border between destruction and self-destruction. And he put together what is happening in Bosnia, Somalia, with the riots, race riots in the United States. I do believe he has got to something extremely important. What is most important for these parties is intensity. It's not ideology. If basically you're going, from this point of view, it's very different than the 1930s. In the 1930s, both far left and far right, they were pedagogical projects. They were dreaming about a new man. This new man was looking very differently on the left and on the right, but they basically dream about the future. Now you fear the future. You want to stop time. There is a really nice book by a Bulgarian novelist, Georgi Gospodinov, Time Shelter, in which he's telling the story of European Union being so kind of impossible anymore to think about the future, so they decided to organize a referendum in every nation states in which decade of 20th century you want to go back. And I do believe this is very important. This is a society infected with nostalgia and very much shattered by intensity. And I'm going to end up with a word because my English, as you can easily detect, is not particularly brilliant, so all the time I'm learning new words. But there is one word that, in my view, really interestingly defines the time in which we are. And this is the word furo.
What is the word?
Furo is the word, for example, that you're using for cats that have been living in a human environment. They have been living with people, and then suddenly they end up on the street. They end up, and they have a totally different type of survival instincts. They're very different than the cats that have never been living with humans. So I do believe what's happening to our societies without democracy is that we went furo.
Oh my God. Okay, just one more explanation, because I just wanted to tell the audience that identity politics in the English-speaking world is used a bit wider as we do it here in Germany. It's not about wokeness and queerness and language. It's this kind of renationalization of politicians, as both of them just explained. And this, here's the question, please a short answer, because we want to talk about the US as well. Ivan, this is why you regard the war in Ukraine, you always say it's a war about identity and not about territory. Can you just give two lines on that?
I'm going to give two lines. Listen, normally in the wars, you're killing people because they're not like you. And you want them, basically, to separate them. In a certain way, President Putin is killing Ukrainians, believing that by doing this, they're going to recognize that they're Russians. If this is a genocide, this is a genocidal inclusion, not genocidal exclusions. Why this is the case? Because one of the major things that is happening these days is that suddenly, for the first time since 700 years, we are living in the age of a massive depopulation. suddenly you don't have people. And in the year before the war started, Russian president, without being asked, started to repeat one and the same thing. If it was not for the wars, if it was not for the revolution, there were going to be 500 million Russians in the world today. And now they're only 145 in a very huge territory. So suddenly the Ukrainians should be Russians because there is not enough Russians. And this way, this explains also kidnapping of kids in the beginning of the war. And my story is, there was always wars, but quite often this is that you have too many people, this is Malthusian fears, and you want to get territory in order to have resources, in order to have people normally go to Ukraine because of its black earth. This time you go for people. This is with my colleague Stephen Holmes, we have been writing this. This is like the morning wars in America from 17th and 18th century, where after diseases and wars, different North American tribes, simply there is not enough people, and you're attacking the other tribe and you're going to kidnap their wives and kids in order to compensate for the missing people. So my major argument is we are entering the age of a population wars. It's not about land anymore.
Finden, from all you have learned while studying your subject of the Irish conflict, are there, because this conflict has ended, it could be resolved in 98, so can you give us any optimistic experiences, guidelines for the other burning conflicts of these years? We talked already a bit on the Ukrainian war. So, but what about Israel-Palestine? How could a peace, what could a peace process look like, or where would it have to start?
So to be slightly optimistic, as you say, this conflict did end, by the way, and it ended in a way which was extremely deliberate, right? So it didn't end, it could still be going on. Right. So because it had this momentum of tit for tat, as we say in English, right? You do this and I do that, you know, it could go on.
It has migrated into German, tit for tat.
Tit for tat, right. So you know what I mean. So it ended in an extraordinarily deliberate way, which is about politics, you know. And this is why we can afford some kind of optimism, actually. How it ended was that you had two governments which had traditionally been in opposition to each other, the Irish government and the British government, started to work together in a really serious way. I mean, so there was a period of about 5 years leading up to the peace talks in 1998, where even as a journalist, you couldn't get anybody on either side to say anything different from what the other government was saying. You know, as journalists, we're always trying to explore the conflict or the contradiction. So this was incredibly serious diplomatically to make sure that there was one voice. And the one voice was, we are withdrawing our claims on population. You know, so we're doing it simultaneously. We're moving at the same time. So Britain is saying, we have no claim on Northern Ireland other than what the people of Northern Ireland want. And at the same time, Ireland, my country, says, we have no claim on Northern Ireland other than what the people of Northern Ireland want. And so what we need is an act of self-determination. Right, which actually says, well, what do people want? And then you have to do something else, which you have to say, how do you stop people feeling that if they don't win, they are destroyed? So the logic of this kind of tribalized politics is, I can't afford to lose. I can't accept the results of an election if I haven't won it, because I don't have the promise that you have in democracy, as we think of it, right? Which is that, well, next time we might win, you know? No, you know, you get into this sort of existential mindset where if we lose, we die. If we do not win, our future as a people no longer exists. Right. So how do you disarm that bomb? And you have to do it with, so you remember in the Cold War, there was this phrase, mutually assured destruction, which also had the lovely acronym in English, MAD, M-A-D. And you have to do sort of mutually assured survival. You actually have to say, everybody will get a guarantee, which is internationally accepted, right? Written into international law, that you will have a right to be who you think you are for as long as you want to think it, right? And the formula that was used in Northern Ireland, and it's actually very interesting in terms of what Ivan was saying, because it was about saying, this is not about territory anymore. So actually, it's an optimistic spin on what you're talking about, right? Which was, so these conflicts, this was a classic conflict about territory. Who really owns this bit of the island of Ireland? Stop that. Say, no, it's about people. Actually, it is about population. And what can people live with? Not what are people willing to die for. So people are willing to die for a sense of my tribe is under existential threat and I will kill and die for that. And then you have to change that. You have to say, what can you live with? You know, and human beings are actually very good at living with stuff, so long as you take away the sense of existential threat. And so the formula that was used in the Belfast Agreement in 1998 was, it is the birthright of everyone in Northern Ireland to identify themselves and be recognized as Irish or British or both, as they may so choose. Right? So it just says, look, you can be whatever the hell you want. You know, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. You can be Irish. You can be British. You can be both. And it's a matter of choice, which means you might change it. Right? And then we changed the constitution in the Republic of Ireland. We had a kind of classic, you know, irredentist constitution saying, Northern Ireland is ours, we want it back. We changed it to say, it is the aspiration of the Irish nation to unite in harmony and friendship all those who share the territory of the island of Ireland in all the diversity of their identities and traditions, right?
So that was the trick.
It's a redefinition of national aspiration. It's a redefinition of identity. It's a redefinition of how it was. And the underlying thing is that this, it was also said that no change in the status of Northern Ireland will affect the right of people to have their identity as they identify, right?
Yeah.
So that calms everybody down. It gets the violence out of the conflict. And then what starts to open up is a lot of people, and this is what's happened in Northern Ireland, the conflict's not over in a way, it's still very tribalized, but you've got an increasing number of people in the middle who say, I don't want to be Irish or British or both. I don't want to be Catholic or Protestant. I'm European, or I'm a feminist, or I'm a LGBTQ person, or I'm an environmentalist, or, you know, lots of other ways of people thinking about themselves.
So you're basically back in the golden years before 68 in Ireland, where people didn't ask for each other's identity. This is basically the trick, and I just want to remind you guys, the members of Pembelin here, that our member Omri Böhm is following exactly this concept when he's talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict. For years, he is proposing this one-state solution where everybody can live in peace and security in some kind of this way that you just explained to us. Ivan, there's one question that really is burning to me, but I ask you for a quite short answer because we want to talk about the US elections, but there's one thing that really is so interesting to us in Germany. Why is the conflict in Israel-Palestine so, why has it become so globalized, so charged as a metaphor of for general morality? That's a question.
Listen, it's also very different in different places. One is the change of the narrative. It's not about Cold War anymore, it's about anti-colonial discourse. And for many people, basically, this is how they understand it. But secondly, don't forget that in different places, it's a different conflict. I'm not a specialist on Germany, as you can imagine. In Germany, it's not about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's a German post-war identity. This is it. So in a certain way, you pretend that you talk about something else, but you talk about yourself. Eastern Europe is also a totally different story, because to be absolutely honest, on one level, the state of Israel, as you see this, is very much the result of the nationalist imagination of the early 20th century East Europeans, which were kindly anti-Semitic. But on the other side, basically, the Israel is the embodied kind of a dream of East European right today. Ethnic state, extremely economically successful, extremely military powerful, over-leveraging. So from this point of view, in a certain way, very few people are interested in the concrete nature of the conflict. And as a result of it, the less you know about the concrete story, the more you basically invent and inject everything that otherwise bothers you in your politics. And as a result of it, this is, but no, but I'm not saying this in a negative way. This allows your political imagination to put into this conflict all other things that you're struggling with in your life. And from this point of view, this is the case. Well, for example, Russian-Ukrainian conflict is very difficult to become global because it's very European. For the people outside of Europe, you cannot imagine that Ukrainians who are white and supported by West also claim that they have an anti-colonial fight. Because in their story, you should not be white and you should not be supported by the West. So from this point of view, that's as simple as this.
So you're basically saying that every country in the world has its own pattern of the Israeli-Palestine conflict, and which is basically rooted in their own political discussion.
And also, don't forget that in many countries, this is also about their countries very much physically. In a certain way, for a country like France, it's also very much between the relations between the Jewish and the Muslim community within the country. So from this point of view, you're going to be surprised that the less you know about the conflict, the more easily it can become global in the political imagination.
Thanks a lot. Yes, now the US election, everybody is basically dying. My friends in New York, our mutual friend, even and mine, Stephen Holmes, the day before yesterday, he said to me on the phone, we are trying to stay sane till November 7th. So not very surprisingly, I would like to ask for your individual personal election forecast, and I would like to start with Fintan, who is an expert on the US. Who is going to win? And of course, an explanation of what you think.
Yeah. So the honest answer, of course, is nobody knows. So we're dealing with gut instincts, and I think Ivan's gut instinct and mine might be different, which might make it interesting. My gut instinct is that Harris is going to win. And let me explain as briefly as I can why. So obviously this election is about a lot of things, but it's primarily about status. You know, why has Trump been so successful? He's been so successful because he taps into what is the great energy of the far right in America and elsewhere, right? Which is perceived loss of status. That's really what it's about, right? Why is it backward looking? It's because you perceive yourself as having had a certain kind of status, which is being taken away from you. And why this is so powerful is that it's almost irrelevant whether you actually had that status or not. Right. Self-pity, which is what's driving this, is a sort of floating emotion, right? It's not anchored necessarily in reality. If you always travel in first class on the plane and then suddenly one day you have to turn right and sit down in economy class with people like us, you will feel so sorry for yourself. I mean, you will feel like it's a terrible injustice, you know? Whereas if you always just travel in economy class, you don't even think about it, right? It's not an issue. Now, there's lots of this going on, and we don't have time to talk about it, but one of the key parts of this, which is going on right now, is male self-pity. Right? Self-pity of men who feel that they have lost their status, particularly white men, but not only white men, by the way. Trump is appealing more and more to young black men, young Latino men as well. This election, and Ivan might have a better idea of this, but it seems to me it is the most gendered Democratic election we have ever seen. And the irony of this is that the woman tried to make it not about gender, right? I was at the Democratic convention, I sat through it all. There was a kind of almost embarrassment when Hillary Clinton spoke, because Hillary Clinton said, this is the next phase of, you know, breaking the glass ceiling, breaking through for women. I may have failed, but Kamala is going to carry on the fight. And Kamala got up and spoke and said, I'm not going there. No, that's not what I'm doing. Why? Because Hillary lost, right? So you've had this very strange, I mean, it's weird in all sorts of ways, but Kamala saying, my gender is irrelevant, also saying my race is irrelevant, and we could talk about race, but we won't go into that either, but even on the gender question. And then Trump being absolutely outraged that he wasn't fighting Joe Biden. I mean, Trump was going to win, by the way. There was no question. I mean, Trump, by the time of the Republican convention, Trump was the winner. No question about that. After his resurrection.
The attack. Yeah. You know,
and so then this woman comes along, and he has to fight this woman. So he makes it about gender. And his instinct, and we know his instincts are pretty good, is the only way he can win is by tapping into this male resentment. Now, the reason I think just about Kamala might make it is because in spite of her not fighting that battle, which I think she should have fought it more, the evidence is that women are going to vote more than men because they always have. It's, you know, women get up and go out and vote to do it, you know. There's about, from the 1960s onwards, there's been about a 5 or 6% gap. I mean, but, you know, women have voted about 5% more than men.
And I didn't know that.
And the gender gap, yeah, so a majority of voters since the 60s have been female. And the gender gap in voting intentions is enormous. I mean, it's absolutely staggering. We're talking about a 30% gap, you know. And if you look at the numbers, more decent men are going to vote for Kamala Harris than bad men are going to vote for Trump. I'm sorry, I'm being facetious here. But, than women are going to vote for Trump. There's a bigger male support group for Kamala than there is a female one for Trump, which means that actually the gender factor seems to me to be the one that will be decisive. And just to finish on this, the evidence is every election since Roe versus Wade was overturned, so we've had the kind of midterm elections, more women have voted than were picked up in the polls, and they've been decisive. They've made a huge difference. That's my gut feeling.
So
it could be completely wrong.
The
but if America is saved and if the world is saved, it's going to be down to women.
Wow, this is quite something. Ivan, the world, the disorder of the world will be greater if Trump is elected? Or would you not, or is this more complex to answer? The disorder of the world, which is already quite a struggle between nations, the whole thing of power nations and the... What do you think?
No, listen, I first believe that if Trump is elected, it's going to be a totally different Trump. And we know from Eastern Europe. By the way, in Eastern Europe, from time to time, I have the feeling that we have been working like a trail for the American elections. The first, basically, the populist leader comes to power. And then he's defeated by a mainstream politician who said, let's go back to normality. And then, this was, by the way, the first time Tusk defeated Kaczynski. This was basically when Orban lost. But the second coming of a populist leader is totally different. because now they're coming to a dramatic change. And one thing that, in my view, is important to understand the United States, Democrats and Republicans disagree on almost everything with the exception of one. Both of them don't believe that this is their country anymore. On the Democratic side, they don't believe that so much racism and so on is possible. And on the Republican side, they don't believe that this is their country anymore because of war and all this. As a result of it, there is something strange about these elections, and this is why you have this apocalyptic story that this is the last elections. If I'm going to lose now, I can never win anymore. And this is why one of the really difficult things, the first is not who is going to win, what is going to happen on the night of the elections. We really have a major risk of contested elections. Trump did it once in 2020, but don't forget, back then it was COVID. People are not very much in a street mood. Now the level of the Republicans believing that they're winning, and this is exactly what Fenton said, he was going to win over Biden. This way, by the way, my intuition, which is normally wrong, so this is a good news for everybody. My intuition is that Trump can make it, and going back to statistics, I'm most of the cases wrong, so this is a good that I have this intuition. But one of the important things is that what is going to happen if Trump is going to win is not what Trump will do. The problem is going to be Trump's with a small t in plural in different places. For example, Trump is not going to be interested, particularly in the first year, much more about outside of the United States, with the exception probably of the two wars. But then there are going to be people speaking for Trump. In Europe, Orban is going to speak for Trump. In Europe, basically, when Trump is coming, many political leaders are going to change their positions. This is going to happen in other parts of the world. So it's not what Trump will do, it's the Trump effect. What Trump will do is going to affect the United States dramatically. But then you have the Trump effect. On the other side, even if Harris is going to make it, the world is not going to be back where it was. And from this point of view, Biden was very much clear. The world is moving in a certain direction, and this direction is neither highly optimistic, and this idea of talking about defending liberal order does not sound legitimate anymore. Obviously, everybody is trying to adjust and to deal with disorder, and this is going to be, by the way, very difficult for Harris. It's going to be difficult in the Middle East. It's going to be difficult in Russia, Ukraine. So I'm saying all this because Trump is going just by winning, changing our country without doing anything. I'm not talking about the tariffs which are going to come. I'm not talking about trade war with China or probably unsuccessful thing in dealing with the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. But there are three things that unfortunately make me believe that he still have a chance. One is he played on one extremely strong card. He went to the Americans and said, I don't care about anybody else but you. I don't care about Ukrainians. I don't care about this and that. Till when we're going to care about everybody else? So suddenly this is so much against American exceptionalism. I care only about you. And you should trust me because I'm mean and I'm nasty and I can play this. And secondly, he said, I'm the guy of peace. And this is a country totally exhausted of wars. And he said, I'm going to make a peace because I don't have any moral consciousness. I don't care about this and that. Betraying people is not something that makes me feel uncomfortable. And they know that he's saying the truth. And from this point of view, it's very strange because it can fit to a certain type of a moment in which Americans really want to go back home. And he symbolizes this American normality. We don't want to be better than anybody else. We just want to be better. And in my view, this is what worries me, but I very much agree with the gender story. And I was saying to Fenton, for me, the great story is how in 4 or 8 years, the mothers of boys are going to vote. Because one of the things that we see, there is obviously a young man problem all over. In realization, and this is real, by the way. It's a real, it's not simply a talk. How they're going to vote? With their feminist identity, or this world is unfair to my boys? And this is going to be probably the other big question in the American electoral politics if they're going to be next elections.
So thank you both, Fintan, Ivan. It's an incredible honor that you have been with us. And yeah, thank you so much for coming here.